Thanks, Shane. Thank you very much. Phoebe, where are you? There you are.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Thanks very much, Phoebe. Good afternoon on this Tuesday afternoon. How are you? 51551 ray@rte.ie. So originally it was for people not over 70. Then it was for nobody. Then it was for everybody. And now it's for only people over 60. It's confusing, isn't it? It's complicated. And not surprising that people will be asking questions. And there will be a little bit of hesitancy about taking a vaccine that's gone through the mill. Four different announcements on four separate occasions. I was just looking at a piece in The Independent today about how other countries have reacted to AstraZeneca. I see France, they're only giving it to over 55s. The United States have decided not to give out the AstraZeneca vaccine at all. Germany, like ourselves, nobody below 60. Canada, nobody below 55 gets it. Italy, the same as ourselves, only people over 60. And the UK have advised, the UK's NHS recommended that anyone under the age of 30 without underlying health conditions should be offered an alternative vaccine if available. And it's because of this blood clotting condition that's a side effect between 4 and 10 in a million, they're saying. So it's and I was just worrying about people this morning when I was listening to Karina Butler on Morning Ireland. People who've got the first dose of AstraZeneca who are under 60 and they're waiting for the second one now. And now they're hearing the announcement that it may not be safe for people under 60. There's a problem here, isn't there? There is a problem because it's feeding it to people who are anti-vaccination. Now, people are shouting at the radio already. Some people are saying, oh, you've been paid by Big Pharma, sure, aren't RTE controlled by men with lizard heads and big tech and all that sort of thing. And anything you say now, Ray Darcy, is because you're in their pockets. But that's not the case. I'm trying to talk a bit of sense. And we spoke to a lady who wrote a book about vaccine hesitation. Stuck was the name of it. And one of the things she said, which I'd never heard said before, she's an academic and she studied people's attitudes and reaction to vaccinations all over the world. And one thing she said was that oftentimes the reaction to vaccinations is not about the actual medicine involved. It's about the relationship between the person who's been vaccinated and the authority, whether it be the government or the NHS or the HSE or whoever is administering the vaccination. And that's where the problem lies. And she said over and over again, it's about the messaging. It's not good enough just to say that the science says so. That doesn't work anymore. And she said the messaging around vaccination is hugely important. Of course, all we're getting at the moment is confusion and changes and all of that sort of thing. And there's no parallel messaging from the government to tell us that everything is going to be okay, that this is a very efficient vaccine, that the occurrence of between 4 and 10 in a million, and that's not even proven yet, is, you know. And then the other thing, and Jenny reminded me before I left the house this afternoon, that if you look at the side effects from the pill, now it's not the same sort of blood clotting, but it is serious blood clotting, that 12 women per 10,000 are about 500 to 1,200 cases per million when it comes to the pill. And that's out there, all over the place. Somebody in your house, somebody you know, that woman taking the pill. And look at the odds there. 500 to 1,200 as opposed to 4 to 10 in a million. So I'm calling on whoever is responsible for the messaging around this. I know you can't give a certainty. And I know, as Karina Butler said on Morning Ireland this morning, there will be other twists and turns before we get to the end of this. But as we twist and as we turn, we need to be held by the hand to reassure us that everything's going to be okay. And it's not good enough to say, oh, well, science says so, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. You'll be okay. That's my call, if there's somebody responsible for that within the government. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now, Wolfwalkers didn't get the Oscar, didn't get the BAFTA, but it'll be some consolation to them that Reese Witherspoon is tweeting about. This is Cartoon Saloon, who made Wolfwalkers, who are based in Kilkenny. It'll be some consolation to them that Reese Witherspoon has tweeted, "Just watch Wolfwalkers with the kids. So wonderful. Adventure, magic and fierce friendship all in one show." Now, I don't know how many followers Reese Witherspoon has, but that's a vote of confidence, which they'll be high-fiving each other. Oh, yeah, the Oscars haven't happened yet. Sorry, they're on... hopefully they'll win now. Yeah, I've sort of hexed it in a positive way for them. So that's positive news there, and that's positive for the Oscars. The BAFTAs happened over the weekend. The Oscars are on the way, and they've been nominated for their fifth Oscar, have Cartoon Saloon. This is an interesting one. If you're at home there looking out at the grey skies turning blacker by the minute, well, they are in Dublin anyway, and you're thinking to yourself, oh, wouldn't I love to be on a Greek island with the aquamarine sea and the blue sky and a tall, cold drink on the table beside me? Well, 200 Dutch tourists have traded lockdown for 8 days of sunshine and relaxation in a Greek beach resort on Rhodes Island, the second largest of the Greek islands. And you're going, how can they do that? What's going on there? Well, it's all above board and backed by the Dutch government and encouraged by the Greek Tourist Board and organised by Sunweb. So 200 people, they advertise this. It's sort of like an experiment to see if they can let people holiday in the sun and make it work in the pandemic. So they advertised it in the Netherlands. 25,000 people applied. And now 200 people are gone. They're there. €399 each to enjoy all-inclusive access to the pool, restaurants and other facilities at the Mitsis Grand Hotel Beach. But nothing else. See, you can't stray outside the confines of the hotel and their little beach area in front of it. You can't go to the pub down the road or that lovely restaurant that you read about in The Lonely Planet or whatever. You can't do any of that. So you're restricted to the resort and you're restricted to the 2 metre distance for people outside of your little bubble. And tour operator Sunweb have organised and said, for the travel industry, it's extremely important. I don't think a lot of companies will survive another summer without travelling. Confining people to resorts, however, probably won't be the solution in the long run, he added. I don't know. Initially you go, oh yeah, I'd love it. Sure, look, I'll be swimming in the sea, in the Mediterranean, lovely, all that sort of thing. And then you get to day three and you're coming up to the what do they call it? The second thing, Oh, it'll come to me. And that's a senior moment. You come to the food again and it's the same as the night before and you recognise the pasta from the night before has been reheated and same waiter and all that sort of thing. And you go, oh, I'd love to go to a different restaurant. And when nobody's looking, you sprint down the beach and make your escape out into the... And that's what's going to happen there. Or maybe the Dutch are more compliant than we are. Now, that's that. That's a big break. Micro breaks. Just for people working from home, they're telling us that it's important that we have micro breaks. Most of us try and push through the fatigue and power on, but new research suggests we might be better off taking a micro break instead. Micro breaks are short pauses away from your desk or workstation, a time to do anything from having a snack and chatting to a co-worker to working on a puzzle or doing some stretches. And I think... And I don't know if you agree with me, you can let me know at 51551, that if you're working from home, you're less likely to take any breaks because you feel guilty. I know I do. That if, you know, if I'm out away from the computer for more than 2 minutes, I feel guilty. I should be working here. Whereas if you're actually in the office, you'd be more likely to go into the canteen, you know, strike up a conversation with somebody. Well, you sure sit down for a sec. Oh, yeah. Half an hour gone before you're back to your desk. That won't be happening at home. And then, of course, the trip to the loo is only 2 seconds, whereas at least when you're at the office, you go down, you might meet somebody in the car on the way back and you have the chat and all that sort of thing. None of that's happening for people who are working from home and not in the office. Bad news for a lady in England. She is the owner of the world's largest rabbit, Annette Edwards. Darius is the rabbit's name. I'm looking at a picture of Annette and Darius. He is ginormous. He looks like something not from the real world, but from the fantasy world of Alice in Wonderland. He weighs 1,000 pounds. That's the reward. There's a reward of 1,000 pounds to get Sterling. He's 4 foot in size. As Annette is offering a reward of 1,000 pounds. Seemingly, he's famous in the UK. He's been on various TV programmes with Jimmy Carr and other people. And Worcestershire is where Annette lives, and she's desperately seeking Darius. So if you spot Darius, and if you spot him, I'd be afraid of him. Now, if I was out of a night and Darius came bounding towards me, I'd be going, ah! 515-51-RAY@RTE.ie. I must tell you about our quiz of today. Let's go with this. Here we go. Today, 13th of April, and we've cobbled together 10 questions on events that happened on this day over the years, the decades, the centuries. And we're looking for two people to come on and answer 5 questions each and maybe win a prize. Well, one of you will. And the prize comes from The Dylan, a 5-star luxury boutique hotel, a magical place where guests can relax in the plush, stylish surrounds of the Ruby Room with its extensive cocktail menu or dine inside or out in the stylish Edison and Nursery Terraces. The price is an overnight stay for 2 people in a luxury double room and is inclusive of a full Irish breakfast in the Edison restaurant. Dylan.ie for more information. So, if you want to be involved and come on after 4 o'clock and answer 5 questions, you have to answer a qualifying question first. And here's today's. In which Irish county would you find the Giant's Causeway? In which Irish county would you find the Giant's Causeway? 1850-715-900. That's 1850-715-900. And we could be talking to you after 4 o'clock. There you go. Brendan has been on. He says, I'm no fan of government messaging during the pandemic, but in all fairness, there has been no shortage of positive messaging about AstraZeneca for the last 24 hours, but fears cannot be massaged away so easily. And now with the Johnson & Johnson situation, all the messaging in the world is going to be fighting very, very hard to compete. Take care. P.S. The clothing involved in taking... the clotting involved in taking the pill is of a totally different kind of the clotting that people are worried about in relation to vaccines at the moment. I did say they were different. Worked for a Dutch company for 2.5 years, and I can say categorically, no rules will be broken. That's a sort of a generalisation, isn't it? No, don't agree. I take lots of breaks, Lucy, in Galway. Yeah, you see, I suppose it depends on what type of person you are, and, you know... I just feel guilty if I'm away from the desk. That's just me. 515-51-RAY@RTE.ie. I'm reading a fascinating book at the moment, The Science of Happiness by Professor Brendan Kelly. Brendan is a psychiatrist, and he's also has a degree in Buddhist studies. So he's a unique view of the world of spirituality and happiness and well-being. And it's a great book, The Science of Happiness. Couple of things I can share with you before we talk to Brendan on Thursday. 47 on average is when you're the most unhappy, the age of 47. And he explains why. And the other thing is, and I was taken aback by this, that in general, and these are generalizations from studies all over the world on happiness, that married people without children are happier than married people with children. I was shocked by that. There you go. 515-51-RAY@RTE.ie. Good afternoon. Kate Bush. Cloud Busting on RTE Radio 1. And that was featured in a movie or a film, as the saying Kildare, that I watched over the weekend and I want to highly recommend to you. Palm Springs. Andy Samberg and Christine Milotti. You'll recognise them when you see them. It's on Prime Video. I don't know if you have that. Palm Springs. It's sort of a Groundhog Day with an edge for the 21st century. It's one of the best films I've seen in a long time. Palm Springs. Highly recommend from here. Forget your Beyoncés and your Kylies. Kate Bush was the fantasy woman of my teens. What a voice, says that person. And I've just been told by my beloved wife that married men are the happiest men around. So there, it's Kevin. Is there scientific research to back that, Kevin? On scientific research, John says, I think Ray has not been helpful or responsible with his vaccine comments. It was noted on radio this morning that blood clotting from the pill is much less serious than with COVID vaccine. That's why the experts are being very cautious, and rightly so, says John. No, I think my main gripe is with the messaging. because, and I would have been of this school of thought, that as long as you say publicly that the science backs a particular decision or whatever, that that's sufficient. But I don't think it is. It might be sufficient for the scientists and the politicians, but for the general public, I don't think it is sufficient. I have to agree, it can be more intensive working from home in terms of the amount of screen time. I definitely feel guilty if I go downstairs for a break. I feel I'm rushing back to my desk in case I miss any calls and the boss may be wondering why I'm not picking up. And then you have to come back sometimes and, you know, the phone has rang and missed a call and you go, oh, I was in the toilet. You end up telling people that you half know that you're in the toilet. Maybe Darius the Rabbit has been taken to Middlesbrough. Uh-huh. Whoever took him should have a warrant issued for his or her arrest. Thanks, Noel. Doom Beg, the pun king. And Harvey the Rabbit was 6 foot in Jimmy Stewart's film. He was, but he was an imaginary rabbit, wasn't he? Yes. And Linda's been on. The word you were looking for is buffet. It is. I couldn't find a buffet in me brain. That happens sometimes, doesn't it? Tell me it does. I agree totally. Same food, same people, gets very repetitive when you're stuck in a resort. Coleman Nocter, child and adolescent psychoanalyst, is with us today. And he can offer advice, and very good advice at that, on any parenting issues you might have or any issues around back to school or dealing with COVID and dealing with the lockdown and all that. So if you have any questions that you want Coleman's advice on, get them into us now, ray@rte.ie. That's ray@rte.ie. And I'll just arm this and press the button and we should be okay there. There you go.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Do you remember that rare and wonderful occasion when the teacher would announce that you'd be having class outside on a sunny day? Well, Spain have taken it one step further by having class outside on the beach, no less. Outside the Felix Rodriguez de la Fuente school, mask-wearing children sit before a portable blackboard at rows of green desks neatly spaced out on a sandy beach. We've been told more and more that we'd be living outdoors because of the pandemic and the way the world is changing. So is it time for the classroom to move outside a bit more? Kira Hinksman owns and runs Forest School Ireland, which is part of the Irish Forest School Association. And Kira's on the line now. How are you doing, Kira?
Oh, I'm doing great, Ray. I'm outside. Oh, not in Spain, but I'm sitting out in the sun at least.
Look at you.
Well, it's a tough job, you know, but somebody's got to do it.
Yeah. So thanks so much for taking our call. And tell us a little bit more about Forest School Ireland. How long have you been doing it and what is it?
I started out about 10 years ago. I tried to bring bushcraft and nature connection for children out into the world and wasn't taken up quite as well as Forest School did when we brought the first training to Ireland in 2013. So since I've been a qualified Forest School leader, I've just found that the demand and the benefits of outdoor learning have just taken off hugely in Ireland. I'm delighted to say our culture and our school system, for the most part, really sees the benefits of the type of learning that we can do outside.
Okay.
Even so, with the weather we have.
because we wouldn't be as blessed with weather as they are in Spain. You go into a school as opposed to you being a school.
Exactly. It's not that there's a school building per se where people come every day to do Forest School, but there's lots of different ways to do it. So personally, I run homeschool groups where children come from within the county. They come and they come to me for the day. We do Forest School for the whole day. Or I might work with an after-school group or often going into schools to run Forest School programs on a long-term basis with the school. But you might have a teacher who's trained as a Forest School leader in your school or early year service, and that can be part of your school culture and curriculum throughout the year for all kids. So that's a really great way to incorporate it into learning for children.
And there's more to it, Kira, than like what we would have done back in the day, a nature walk.
Yeah, not really into nature walks myself.
Not really.
But do you remember when you were a kid? I'm making assumptions here, but that you might have spent the day out on your bike or out exploring.
Yes,
you might have been somewhere within the ditch and there was making or doing things out there. So we're trying to really encapsulate that idea that children learn incredibly beautifully, and it's marvelous to watch how they learn when they're allowed to explore doing something really fun themselves. So they might be trying to figure out how to put up a swing. And I'll be standing beside them. I can teach them the knots, but I'm going to wait and watch and see how they figure out how to get the rope over the branch and see how long it takes them. It might take a whole troop of them to get this piece of rope over. It might take them weeks coming back trying to figure it out. And when they do get it, I'm there to make sure it's safe. Right. So I'm facilitating them engaging with the environment. We have all sorts of nature crafts, we have tools, we're looking at plants. We're really being watching what they're interested in every week and following what they're really loving to do. And when they're ready, they're just absorbing all the information. So we're creating a really fertile experience of learning for them where they're totally ready to learn. Instead of saying, you're going to learn this knot now, we're waiting until they kind of go, God, can you please teach me this knot? I really want to know how to put up a swing and it's going to work.
It sounds brilliant. It sounds idyllic.
It's great fun. Yeah, it's a lot of work, but it's great fun for the kids. We do a lot of work around, the boring part of being a practitioner means you have to be really insurance savvy. Yes. You've got to have all your risk assessments done. So we've really thought loads about all of that, but the children just feel like they've decided everything that's happening and they're having a great time.
So the sort of practicalities of it, that you get you get a phone call and some principal says, we'd love you to come along for, is it a day or a number of days, or what way does it work?
So for our school, the ethos of that is that it's a long-term process. There's time. These kids have time. So you're not trying to fill the cup in one day. So you start on week one, you'd want to be doing a minimum of 10 sessions if you can. So it might just be a two-hour session once per week as part of the school day. They tootle into the school grounds. Maybe tree planting might become part of your program, so you can build up a little woodland, or you're planting some wildflowers. But really, you're just going out into a natural space and you're introducing things for them to take up and to choose. So it might be tools. If you're allowed, maybe a little bit of fire making with fire steel, which is a really tricky technique to learn when you're five. We might be looking at plants and making our natural dyes, whatever. Yeah. So we will also have options for them to do their own thing. So you would watch what they're interested in. And the following week, you bring back things that they really like doing and extend their learning. Right. So if they're really into, you know, what do you want to do next week?
Okay, bugs. That's what you want. More bugs, miss. More bugs. Yes.
Yeah, don't eat the bugs. Be nice to the bugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, we'll have the stuff there, and there might be kids who love bugs, and there might be kids who don't want to do that. They really need to play big play with, you know, building dens, and that's what they do. So you have your enough adults around who are hanging back, they're watching, they're keeping everyone safe. They're there to play with them if they ask. But you're really watching the whole class learning what they need to be learning that week. So it's good for the teachers too. They get to see the kids that might really not do well in class do brilliantly outside, because they don't sit in a
It's a break in the routine for everybody involved, teachers and pupils.
Exactly. So you have to have good clothes. That's the big thing. Have your outdoor jacket.
Yes.
And then you can go out. Yeah.
Isn't there a Swedish saying, isn't it, that there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothing? Isn't that,
I know. And for a country like us, you'd think we'd be a bit better by going outside in the rain. We don't like it
much. So irishforestschoolassociation.ie for more details. irishforestschoolassociation.ie.
So on there, there's a map. There's forest school leaders throughout the country. I know we're all not able to operate now unless you're working within a school or with a school, but there's a map of people there who'll be out all summer offering work and opportunities. So please check out the Irish Forest School Association map of practitioners, and my company is forestschoolireland.ie.
Brilliant. Thanks, Ciara. Thanks for taking time out.
Care.
Bye. Mind yourself.
Thanks,
see you. Bye. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Yeah, or Ray at RTE.ie. We were talking about lying at the beginning of the show a couple of weeks ago. You might remember I informed you that you're lied to between 10 and 200 times a day. Strangers lie 3 times within the first 10 minutes of meeting each other. Extroverts lie more than introverts. Men lie 8 times more than about themselves, whereas women tend to lie to protect other people. And there's loads and loads of facts and scientific research about lying in a book called Lie Spotting, which is a good, it's 10 years old, but still it's held up as one of the publications on lying. And its author, Pamela Meyer, is on the line from New York. Pamela is CEO of Washington-based Calibrate. Good afternoon, good morning, Pamela.
Hello, how are you? Great to talk to you.
Yeah, you're a liar, I'm a liar. We're all liars.
We're all liars, every one of us. We all do it.
but even saying that, I felt uncomfortable saying I'm a liar because it's frowned upon.
Yeah, the word is really a trigger word in our culture, but in fact, it's a word that describes how we navigate complexity often. Not all lies are bad, really.
Right. So why do we lie, Pamela?
Well, you know, we all do lie, and we lie for very, very different reasons. And when I think about lying, I like to think about, like, the offensive lies and the defensive lies. So sometimes we lie just to obtain a reward that we couldn't get or to gain an advantage over somebody or to create a positive impression or win admiration. Other times we lie to really control information. But many times what we do is we're really lying to protect privacy or to get out of an awkward situation or to protect somebody else from being punished or to avoid embarrassment. So there are lots of parts of conversation and sort of who we are as humans that involve deception in some way, and it really is part of human nature.
And what's the evolutionary value of lying? Why has it survived?
Well, cavemen, you know, they had to lie to get what they needed, right? And so it starts very, very early. We know that even primates lie to some extent. You know, Coco the gorilla, the very, very famous gorilla that knew sign language, Coco once lied, you know, claiming that, you know, her pet kitten had ripped a sink out of the wall. I mean, they all lie. She used sign language doing it. But we know that it's just part of the human condition.
Right. I suppose your expertise is spotting lying. And you've been doing this for years and years and years. And does that make you a better liar?
Oh, yeah, I'm really good now. You got to be careful. but I'm not a good liar. I'm not a good liar in the presence of a good lie spotter, because what we do in my business and what I do with people as well is we train them not just to spot the lies, but how to get the truth. Because when you think about it, it's not that meaningful knowing that somebody lied unless you actually know what the truth is behind that lie. So there's a real science that's evolved over the last number of years in terms of what we call information elicitation that really helps you get to the truth and not just look at those particular indicators saying that someone's lying.
Okay, so you get the truth without using any sort of torture or anything like that. It's sort of just ways of talking and questions that you ask, etc.
Yeah, I mean, it depends if you're my husband or not.
Do you call out lies? That's something I've watched your TED talk and I've read loads of interviews with you, and something you don't cover is calling out lies.
That's such an important question. I really don't recommend it. You know, it's not, most people when confronted with a lie, they'll just pull back. They're going to get really defensive and it doesn't do you any good. You know, it's better to just get as much information as you can, to sit on it for a while and then think about a way to talk about it that involves giving someone a few off-ramps so they can really communicate to you about why they lied and what the external information may be around that. So, you know, you may say to somebody, look, it's not that big a deal, but I really need to get a better understanding of, like, what happened Friday night. I know you were late. I'm not accusing you of anything, but it would be helpful to understand. You know, and when you talk about it that way with somebody, they're going to be a lot more likely to tell you what was going on than, like, where were you?
Yes.
I know you were at the office with that colleague. It just doesn't work.
Right. Okay. Now, you use this in your TED Talk, and I hope you don't mind if we use this again, because it's classic lying, and it's the sort of the verbals around lying. So I'm going to play this clip of Bill Clinton when he was president of the United States of America at a press conference after the whole Monica Lewinsky controversy. So here we go.
But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Ms. Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Some people were convinced by what he said. Now, we all know now that what he said was a lie, but you would have been able to spot then that what he was saying was a lie.
Well, yeah, I mean, Bill Clinton is what we call a conditioned witness. he's ready. He's at the ready, and he's probably practiced very carefully. But still, you know, there are a bunch of indicators there. You know, when the cognitive load is high and you're trying to think what to say, act composed, appear spontaneous, you leak these verbal cues and nonverbal cues. And the verbal ones on this one, you know, he said, I did not have sexual relations. Well, we know that we call that a non-contracted denial. Did not versus didn't, could not versus couldn't. Uh-huh. Liars will unconsciously formalize their language. And, you know, this data point goes around the world. We see this in every language.
I did
he
not.
Also,
oh, there you
the
go. Just playing it again for them.
Like,
I was just playing it again from there.
Yeah, play it again.
I did not.
Ah, yes. Instead of I didn't.
Right.
I
exactly.
Did not.
Ah, yeah. Very good. Okay. Anything else?
Yeah. I mean, he said, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. Right? I mean, he's distancing himself unconsciously with his language. And liars often do this. They unconsciously distance themselves with the language that they use. They'll use the third person. They'll say that woman. And the other thing that he did is he said Monica Lewinsky. Then he narrowed it. And the thing that we know is that when you're in a denial of having done something and you're lying, oftentimes you narrow the field of your denial. Like Bill Clinton, right? He couldn't say, hey, I never had sex outside my marriage in my life. We know he couldn't say that,
yes.
That categorical denial.
I see, yes,
so
yes.
That people want to appear truthful, so they narrow it so they can actually feel very truthful in what they're saying.
And what about, you know, the detail around a lie? Do people tend to give more detail when they're lying or not?
Well, so oftentimes, I mean, have you ever had teenagers around you? You probably know this, or anybody that's listening does. People will overstate the detail. We call this a lie sandwich. You know, they'll kind of give you too much authentic detail around the lie so they feel like they're being authentic, when in fact what they're doing is that they're providing with an inappropriate amount of statement information, as we say.
Okay.
So oftentimes the detail's way too much.
Right. Now,
because they're trying to seem honest.
The first thing that I studied when I was at college was nonverbal communications. Body language. And I would have thought, and I'd say most of our listeners think, that if somebody's fidgeting, if somebody is looking at the floor as opposed to making eye contact, they're probably lying. But that's wrong.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, first of all, what you need to know about even spotting lies any of the time is that the science is soft. This is like the weather, right? I mean, so you're making a soup and you're doing your research and you're confirming facts and you're observing behavior and you're going to put it all together and intuit what you think is the truth. So there's no fail-proof way of doing it. But the most important thing you can do, and this is what FBI interrogators do all the time, is they baseline someone at first. They come in and they're like, how are you? How was your weekend? Did you go shopping? And what they're doing is they're trying to get a sense of your norm so that they can have a reliable reference point later. So if someone's tapping their foot, it doesn't mean anything if they're a foot tapper.
Yes.
If you say, how was your weekend, and they're tapping their foot and they're nervous, it doesn't mean anything when you ask them the next question that's really important for what you want to know.
Yeah.
So you really have to get a baseline down. People who don't know what they're doing oftentimes just look at stress, or they look at hand wringing, or they look at someone's posture and they see a shift. It doesn't mean anything unless there's a whole set of clusters and unless it really changes from someone's baseline.
And that makes sense, because even like what my knowledge is from movies, etc., but when somebody's taking a lie detector, they ask them some sort of inane questions at the start to establish the baseline.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah.
That's right. Exactly right. They're baselining them.
Okay. Fake news, right? Why do people buy into the lies, do you think?
So, you know, we are so easily conned. You know, we live in our little bubbles. We have what's called confirmation bias. People say things we want to hear. And this is the same thing with fake news. Oftentimes, something will be promised that either confirms a bias that we have or is just something we really wish could be true. And so, you know, for example, people who are fearful of vaccines may really believe all the fake news about vaccines. Well, there's been some new news today about vaccines,
yes.
So I have to
Johnson
be careful about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so we want to be careful with that. But when the vaccines first came out, everyone thought the vaccines could kill you, and there was a lot of, you know, nobody should take them, and because there's a whole history, particularly in America, of bad medical experimentation, and there's a lot of confirmation bias in that. And so people believe the news that they want to believe because either they're fearful or something is promised to them that they really want. And we can all be easily conned by fake news, every one of us.
There's obviously more lying out there because there's more people talking on social media. You know, there would have been conversations in pubs and in sitting rooms and kitchen tables, etc., but they evaporated. Now you know, they're on Twitter, they're on Instagram, they're on da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So there are lies everywhere. Forever.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because while the volume of information and the volume of lies has certainly increased, and I think our moral bar is a little bit lower than it has been at different times in history, at the same time, we're better at pointing them out. There are more mechanisms for transparency as well.
But if somebody lies, they don't have those triggers that they don't have those indicators that we talked about. They don't have, you know, well, maybe the verbal thing, but they definitely don't have the non-verbal communication, the body language, because if it's in 160 characters on Twitter or wherever. So are you studying, you know, the written word and lying through Twitter or wherever?
Yeah, I mean, we are looking at all forms of lying that's out there because there really is a deception epidemic that we're in the midst of.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we have found is that the volume is much higher. Trust is at an all-time low. You know, our trust in institutions has never been lower. That's a huge problem. At the same time, it is possible to train people to figure out what a real source is, ask the hard questions, check with somebody they trust. There's a lot of training that can go into that, and especially with people who are younger and in high school, middle school now, where you can start to get people a little bit more critical in terms of how they take in that information.
But is it fair to say then that that takes effort and that the lazy thing to do is just accept what people tell you?
That's right. You got to keep your antenna up.
Yeah.
It should be a second, you know, like a sixth sense for us. We should, after a while, become better and better at observing the truth, asking the hard questions.
Back to where we started there and the stats that I gave out. So men are 8 times more likely to lie about themselves.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, oh, you know, my high school girlfriend was much better than that, or, you know, oh, she wasn't the best they ever had, or, oh, there's other fish in the sea, it doesn't matter, or I was the VP when, in fact, they were the director. Oftentimes, they'll lie because they were hurt by somebody, or they'll lie because they're increasing their sense of position. We see a lot of lying on dating services, particularly around that. Managed 5,000 people when, in fact, it was maybe 50.
Yes.
So, you know, we are all hardwired to stay ahead of the pack, and men as well do that. You know, I mean, if the caveman told the other caveman where his cave was, he would have lost his woman and the food, right?
Yeah, but then women, by contrast, women are more compassionate in how they lie because they'll go, yeah, that dinner was lovely when they, you know, they didn't like it at all, but they're doing it to protect the other person's feelings.
Yeah, I mean, we find the volume of lies is pretty much equal, but the motivation is somewhat different. I wouldn't say women are better. I wouldn't say women are more moral or more ethical at all. I just think we lie for different reasons. We all manipulate, but for different motivations.
Okay. And that thing, when you meet a stranger, they're likely to lie to you 10 times in the first 3 minutes. Is that the statistic? Did I read that right?
Yeah, I mean, we there are a lot of studies out there, and we've seen the number of from 3 to 200 in a day. But you have to keep that, you know, you have to really think about it, because like a lot of those lies are what we call low-stakes lies. As opposed to, I mean, I'm very concerned much more with high-stakes lies, who to vote for, what house to buy, who to marry, who to hire.
Yeah.
You know, we're more concerned about
Okay, well, let's just, lies. We'll finish up on that then, the high-stake lies. Like, we're sort of surrendering a lot of the stuff to, you know, artificial intelligence and algorithms. Can algorithms spot lies?
Yes, there's a lot of, I mean, we're really hitting a new era where AI is hitting a huge evolution in technology. I sit on the advisory board of a company that's using just pupillometry and eye movements. It's called Converis to tell whether or not people are lying. We've had a complete renaissance in the technology. It's changing really dramatically. It's also quite dangerous because we have facial recognition and invasions of privacy going on all over the world and really the rise of kind of surveillance states. And so we're in this middle moment right now where it's certainly not just a human combat, human behavior that we're looking at. We're also looking at automated machine-generated data. But it could be used for very complex reasons. And so it's a very, very interesting time for lie detection, but also very complex.
Do you think, final question for you, do you need us as humans, do you think we need to be kept on the straight and narrow? Or is this just part of being human?
I think it's part of being human, but I think every one of us has the ability to just raise the moral bar a little bit. okay. and signal to everyone around them that they're honest, because it really does keep the people around them honest.
Yeah, you say in your TED talk, we'll finish with that one, that they're truth seeking and trust building. We need to do that as well as liar spotting. There you go.
Yeah.
Pamela Meyer, that was fascinating. And I mean that, that's truthful. That's, I'm not just saying that as a white liar. That's, I really mean that.
I believe you.
And thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us today.
Okay.
Thanks, Pamela.
Fun.
Bye now. Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Tweet at Radio Ray RTE. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Coleman Octor, child and adolescent psychotherapist, is on the line. Good afternoon, Coleman.
Good afternoon, Ray. How are you keeping?
Good, good. You're coming in loudly and clearly. Now, we'll get straight to it. We've about 7 or 8 minutes, so we'll get straight to it. This one. Dear Coleman, I'm planning on separating from my husband when school finishes up in July. He's an angry drinker. What can I do to help our primary school going children? I'll be moving back home 90 miles away as I have no support here. I have them signed up for school there. And when do I go about telling them? Thanks.
Yeah, this is really tricky. I suppose from the point of view of the first thing I'd say is you have to park your own differences. And it is about putting the children first. And I know so many times that I've met people who've gone through this process, and maybe a few years down the line, the relationship is better than it was initially. And parents' regret is that they didn't manage the early phase better in terms of their own anger with each other, etc. Now, from the point of view of it, if they're living far away and from dad, they're starting new school, they're starting up new friendships, etc. And so that's going to be challenging in itself. But I think from the point of view of reassuring them that nothing is to do with them. So I mean, it's not their fault that this is an issue between the adults, and the adults are resolving it. Now, obviously, the alcohol dynamic is challenging and there's difficulties around that. And you wouldn't know from this email to what degree dad's anger impacts on the children. But obviously, keeping dad involved in some degree and trying to maintain as much safe contact as possible for the children would be important. But they're moving town, they're moving school. There's going to be so much more upheaval that it's going to be something they're going to need to prepare for. So I suppose telling them with a bit of notice, trying to keep as many things the same as possible, and just absolutely parking your own anger, because you don't want the children to be triangulated within the row. It's the biggest error in any kind of parental separation issue, is that the children become tokens of currency, you know?
And of course, this woman can't control what he does. She can only control her own behaviour and what the message she gives to the children.
Absolutely.
That's important.
And I think that's harder, that's easier said than done.
Yes,
but I think
yes.
From the point of view of, it's an investment, Ray, that will pay off. You know, I think even if we are angry and we're resentful or bitter or whatever, I don't know any situation where that had a positive outcome. Does that make
yes,
sense?
Yes, yeah, yeah. It's a good idea, I think, that it's happening at the same time as the school holidays.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the point of view, again, there'll be a natural break there. My own children changed school over the summer holidays, so there was something about starting afresh in September when everyone else is, you know, you're not coming in the new uniform and the new, you know, there's something about a natural transition there that might be useful. Hopefully, if they can get down to their new abode over the summer period, they might get comfortable. Like, don't underestimate the comfort in their own surroundings and their peer groups and all that sort of stuff. These are hugely important in transition, not just about the family home, but also the surrounding social environment and how supportive the school is and that they're welcomed in and all that. All of those things will help hugely, you know.
Yeah, my worry here, Coleman, I don't know if you got it from reading it. I'm planning on separating from my husband when school finishes up in July. Does he know about this, the husband? And if not, is it dangerous for her to discuss this with the children if she's keeping it a secret from him?
I'm really sorry, Ray. Could you repeat that question? Sorry. There was an interference on the line there.
Oh, sorry.
Apologies.
No. I was just saying that I'm worrying that she's keeping it a secret from the husband, and if she's doing that and she's telling the children, you know, that's going to create tension.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that transparency and openness is crucially important in all of this, especially you don't want the heaviest thing a child can carry is a secret, you know, and if they're being told you have to keep this from dad, or just is just between us, or if there's any sort of kind of maneuvers that they're involved in, albeit kind of family espionage, the children need to be spared of all of that. They're far too young to be able to cope with that or manage it. I would definitely be discouraging anything around secrecy or collusions. It has to be above board and open. And again, it's probably the most difficult thing to do now, but it's the most beneficial thing in the longer term, because you have to see this as an investment in the future as opposed to the short-term battles. You can win those, but you can lose the war, if that makes sense.
It's a very difficult time, and our thoughts are with you. It's very difficult. My two-year-old doesn't listen to me when I say don't throw your bowl, don't throw water, or don't touch this or that. She just won't listen to me. I have a baby and she throws things in his bassinet. She doesn't take no for an answer. I'd love to know how to get her to listen. Terrible twos.
Yeah, I mean, again, the capacity of a two-year-old to listen is something I'd question in the first instance. But I think from the point of view of the interesting thing here is the bassinet and the throwing the thing into the baby. I mean, there's definitely something about visibility here. If she's quiet and managing, my guess is that mum and dad are leaving her to it. Where it's when she's kind of oppositional or acting out, that's where she has the lock of their gaze. You know, they're kind of locked onto her. And if there is a competing sibling there at the moment, I would expect some of the escalation in behavior. You know, the sibling rivalry around throwing things in on top of the bassinet or getting very angry when a baby's being breastfed or when the time is dedicated elsewhere. And this child might just be seeing that resistance and oppositionality is, right, that's where you get the quality airtime.
So what's the advice?
I think it's catching her being good. I mean, I think from the point of view, it's rewarding her when she listens as opposed to giving out to her when she doesn't. And there's going to be times throughout the day that she is listening and she is following and agreeing. Like, she's not going to be, for the seven things that she probably is agreeing with, the three things she's not is creating all the attention. So I would be reminding her and treating her and giving her the reinforcement of all the things that she is doing. Like, you know, get your toothbrush and we go in here, or bring your teddy across here. And when she does it, reminding her of how, and she gets the attention from adhering, yes, as opposed to oppositionally going against. I'd be much more incentive-based rather than getting into forcing her to listen, because I think that's just a battle you won't win.
Okay. Coleman, thanks so much. Thank you very much.
Not at all, Ray. Mind yourself.
You too. That's Dr. Coleman Nochter, child and adolescent psychotherapist, and he will be on again in a few weeks. So if you have a question for him, send it into us, ray@rte.ie, and we'll put it on file. Anish Tosha now, and the Free Skeleton in Oakdale, and Maury Breed, Nicoulon. Good morning, Breed. Thank you very much. Could you read out the name and author of that happiness book again, please, Liam in Cork? It's The Science of Happiness, Liam, and it's Professor Brendan Kelly, and we're going to be talking to him on Thursday. So we'll give it loads of mentions on Thursday, and he'll be in with us in Studio 7. It's a fascinating topic. I don't like the word happiness in particular. I like the word content better, but there's loads of science around it. And in the last 10, 15 years, the number of surveys around well-being and happiness all over the world has, you know, exponentially grown. So there's loads of information to share with you on Thursday when Professor Brendan Kelly joins us in studio. Here we go. Now it's time for our quiz of today. 13th of April. 10 questions on the way from events that happened on this day over the years. And a prize too. It comes from the Dylan. 5-star luxury boutique hotel. A magical place where guests can relax in the plush, stylish surrounds of the Ruby Room. With its extensive cocktail menu, or dine inside or out in the stylish Edison and Nursery terraces. Dylan.ie for more information. Now, Geraldine Williams. How are you doing, Geraldine?
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Not too bad. You're in Glasnevin, I say. What do you do for a living?
I'm a special needs assistant.
Right. Have you been back since when? Since yesterday or long before
that? Since before the Easter holidays, but right, then we're back yesterday.
And everybody's back. Everybody's back, yeah.
The whole school, yeah.
Which is great, isn't it?
Oh, it's amazing. It's brilliant. It's great to see them all back.
Yeah. I know from hour two that they might give out about school, but really they were really looking forward to going back and meeting their mates. It's the social aspect of it, isn't it?
Exactly. They miss all their friends and that. You can see it in their faces. We're all thrilled to be back.
You have three children, all grown up, I see.
They're all grown up, yeah.
Any of them still at
home?
Two
girls and a boy. Yeah, just the youngest, Sophie, she's 22. But I was just telling your researcher there, my daughter, Amy, 29, she was on the den with you in 1999.
What was she doing?
She was on, like, the den show, you know, the...
Yeah,
the,
I know, but, like the, we did so many things, like, we did...
Like, the, it was a little quiz. Like
right,
that.
Oh, yeah, the furry green telly quiz or something that, like that, or the yes-no game show or something like that, yeah.
She came home with loads of toys. Yes, I always remember a Woody. She got a Woody and she was thrilled with that.
That's great.
I would make you feel old now, right?
Yeah. And you.
Yeah, me. I'm saying me.
Oh, sorry. I thought you said you make me feel old. Yeah, me.
No.
Yeah, and first grandchild in the family is
it in June. Yeah,
oh,
June,
that's very exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. I'm so excited. A bit of good news, you know.
Yeah.
With all that's happening. Yeah,
and everybody's healthy. It's your son's partner, Vicky.
Vicky, that's right. Alan's son. She's doing brilliant. Everything's going well.
Great.
And, you know, they're over the moon as we are. Like,
great. That's brilliant. Now, Anne Hipwell is up against you. Geraldine, how are you doing, Anne?
Hi, right.
You're in Kilteel in Kildare.
That's me.
Whereabouts is Kilteel? I should know this, being a Kildare man. This is terrible.
It's 5 miles away from Racoole, 5 miles away from Blessington.
Oh, I know where you are there.
Hills.
Yes. It's lovely, that part of Kildare,
near
isn't it?
Near Punchestown as well.
Yes.
It's a hilly part of Kildare.
Yeah, are there a lot of studs and all sorts of things around, horsey
there
things?
Yeah. I can see a few horses out there out the window. They're not mine. Just the neighbour's ones.
And is it a nice day in Kilteel?
Yeah, it's gorgeous. I've been out for two walks. So
two?
I'm trying to lose the COVID stone and a half.
Right, okay. I see you have a son, Sam, age six. All the S's.
Yeah.
And so how was he with school and everything?
He was grand. He went back after Christmas and then he got sick. He was sick for a week and a half and he was only in for a few days and then it was Easter, so look, he's delighted to be back now, thank God.
Right.
And the teachers are great.
We better get this out of the way as well, seeing as there are stories from my past. So we met.
Oh, yeah. Well, I saw you. We didn't meet. You were playing rugby.
Oh, no, I was playing rugby. Oh, God.
Is it North Kildare you used to play with?
No, I played.
Oh, it was a match in North Kildare.
Yes. I played for Kildare. Yeah.
Yeah.
And your dad played for Naas, did he?
He did, yeah. He was a selector. We used to go to all the matches so he could look at people. so he could see who to select and...
Yeah.
So I pointed, I said, Dad, that's Ray Darcy, because you're on the den at the time, speaking of the den again. And he said, oh, yeah, he plays for Kildare.
It's funny because I remember the one thing I remember in North Kildare was going for a trial for... the Leinster junior team. Now, I shouldn't have been on it. Anyway, I was playing out of my skin, playing really well until I got the ball and passed it to the referee.
The opposite.
No, the referee. I passed it to the referee. It was a perfect pass and he caught it and everything. But needless to say, I didn't get selected. Anyway, there you go. Enough stories about my past. Right. Anne and Geraldine, great to have you on. Five questions each. Whoever answers most correctly gets the prize. And if we have a draw, we go to a tiebreak situation. Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Now, coincidentally, this got a mention yesterday, and it'll become apparent why when I read the question. It's your first question, Geraldine. On this day in 2002, Pedro Carmona, interim president of Venezuela, resigned one day after taking office. You see, he took office yesterday, and he resigned 19 years ago. On what continent would you find Venezuela, is the question.
South America.
Correct answer, Geraldine. Anne. On this day in 1979, Yusuf Lule became Prime Minister of Uganda. On what continent would you find Uganda?
Africa.
Correct answer. Geraldine, have a listen to this.
Sunny day, sweeping up.
On this day in 1931, John Stone, American director, was born in New Haven, Connecticut. He was the co-creator of that children's TV show you heard the theme tune from. Can you name it?
Sesame Street.
Is the correct answer. And for you, Anne, have a listen to this. On this day, 1942, Bill Conti, American film score composer, was born in Providence, Rhode Island. He composed the theme music for that movie. Can you name it?
Rocky.
Is the correct answer. Well done. Now, back to you, Geraldine. Can you name the Irish novelist and playwright who was born on this day in 1906 in Fox Rock in Dublin? His most famous works include Endgame, Malone Dies, and Waiting for Godot.
Oh. Brendan Dean?
It wasn't Brendan Dean. It was Samuel Beckett. Samuel Beckett. Oh. Okay. Right, Anne. Can you name the Irish poet and playwright who was born on this day in 1939 in County Derry? His most famous works include Digging, Blackberry Picking and Clearances.
I have no idea, sorry.
Have a guess, Irish poet.
Yeats?
No, it was Seamus Heaney. Seamus Heaney, okay.
Seamus
Heaney, oh yeah. So the two of you are equally bad in Irish literature. Oh. Okay. Right, so it's 2-2. On to question 4 for you, Geraldine. Have a listen to this.
Hello.
Classic. Hello, was that number one on this day in 1984? Can you name the singer?
Lionel Richie.
Lionel Richie is the correct answer. And for you, Anne, in Kilteel, have a listen to this.
Do you feel the same? Am I only dreaming? Or is this burning an eternal flame?
Oh, we're in the middle of a slow set, girls. That song, Eternal Flame, was at number one on this day in 1989. Can you name the group?
They're a girl group, obviously.
They are a girl group, yes. Any idea?
I had their album. Tapao?
No.
Yeah.
It was a good guess, but it's not Tapao. Same vintage, the Bangles we were looking for.
The Bangles.
Yes, there you go.
They did
Manic Monday as well, didn't they?
That's it.
Walk Like an Egyptian. Now, Geraldine, you're one in front and you've one question to go. If you get this right, Anne can't catch you. However, if you get it wrong and Anne gets her final question correct, then we're in a tie-break situation. Good luck with this.
Thank you.
On this day, 1941, a pact of neutrality between the USSR and Japan was signed. Which of these countries has a bigger population than Japan? Right? Which of these countries has a bigger population than Japan? The Philippines, Egypt, or Russia?
Russia?
Egypt, 102 million. Philippines, 109 million. Japan is 126 million. And you're right, Russia, 144 million.
Oh,
well done.
Thank you.
And sorry about that.
That's okay.
Yeah, Eternal Flame, the Bangles, you never forget that.
never forget that.
Great talking to you, and we're going to send you out a Ray Darcy Show mug.
Lovely.
Okay.
Appreciate that.
Thanks,
thank
Anne.
You.
Mind yourself.
Thanks,
see you. Bye.
Congratulations,
bye. Bye.
Geraldine. Bye. Bye.
Geraldine, well done.
Thank you. I'm just thrilled.
You're going to be making the long trip from Glasnevin into the middle of the city to the Dillon at some stage in the future.
Lovely.
For an overnight stay for two people in a luxury double room. And you can
You
can whet your appetite by going to dillon.ie to see what they have to offer.
Thanks so much, Ray.
Great.
Thank
and,
you.
And listen, good luck with everything. Vicky and the Babby and all that sort of thing. Great talking to you.
Lovely. Okay, thank you, Ray.
Bye
you
now.
Too.
Bye, 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 bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or 51551. Somebody wants to know the name of the movie on Amazon Prime, which we recommend it, and it is Palm Springs. Palm Springs is the name of it. Well, if it's a good song, it deserves a second play on RTE Radio 1 of a day. Two Door Cinema Club. And something good can work. Michael Fry is our next guest. He's become a viral sensation over the last year. How you doing, Michael?
I'm great, Ray. How are you?
Good. That sort of label, viral sensation, how does it sit with you?
It kind of makes me cringe a little bit.
Yes,
it's very kind of like
much,
a 2010 description of what the internet is, I guess.
Yeah. I thought as much as I was saying it. Yeah. So how would you describe yourself then? How would you describe your success?
I guess that's the only vocabulary we have is viral sensation or viral hits or that kind of way. I would say I've done well online and in online communities, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I've gotten a lot of followers over the last while, a lot of views, all that kind of stuff. So the metrics are good.
Yeah. So talk to me about the metrics then. So it's millions, isn't it? Is it millions?
Millions of views.
Yeah.
Not quite a million of followers yet. So probably on Twitter, I have about 80,000 followers.
Right. So, which is massive. That's kind of, I've doubled it since November, and it's quadrupled since this time last year. So going pretty good, I think.
Just maybe this is the best way to do it, Michael. So say if you were doing what you were doing 20 mm-hmm. years ago or 25 years ago, where would you be? You know, would you be doing your own radio program? Would you have a sketch show on the telly? Would you be doing gigs, or what would you be doing, do you think?
I think it could be any of those things. It's weird. It's its own kind of new brand or genre of comedy, in that, like, it exists online and I write things for online. And yes. the things that I do are informed by how my audience reacts to me. So it's kind of like stand-up comedy in that way, in that you wait for a laugh and it comes back. But it also, it's not in front of a live audience, so the beats are different and things like that. So hard to describe in kind of older terms.
Yeah, but that's interesting, because you shape your stuff then by the reaction you get. So you know that if something gets 400,000 views, that obviously there's something in it that people like.
Yeah, that is what I do. And a lot of the stuff that I do is worked off suggestions from my fans and from the followers and stuff like that. So it's a reciprocal kind of thing. It kind of works in tandem with them.
Okay. So I'd imagine some of the people listening won't be familiar with your work. So how would you describe to somebody then that you met for the first time?
Yeah, I do a few different things. So right. It's usually kind of characters. I do an Irish mother. I do radio presenters. I do some impressions. I do an Aidan Gillen and I do Michael B. Higgins. And then sometimes I veer into, and this is the most recent thing, I veer into musical comedy. So what I've been doing over the last while is taking clips that have already gone viral and people love and people have been watching for years and years, and turning them into kind of songs. Kind of like Two Door Cinema Club, you just had on that kind yes. of indie kind of sound, and yeah. mashing those two things together. And that seems to be going pretty well.
And so you're musically talented, Michael, as well as comedically talented.
I've always liked music, and I've always loved playing it and messing with it. And I always thought, oh, maybe I'd love to go into that. But it's really nice to bring it into the comedy. It's another skill I can use, another string to my bow to make things funny, I suppose.
Yeah. So I have a few. There, a lot of them we can't play, unfortunately.
Because of my use of the most unparliamentary language.
Yes, exactly. People will be familiar with that. What was the Green TD's name? I used his name in the promo there.
Paul Gogarty,
yes. Yeah. And his reference to Emmett Stagg. And then you used Twink's famous message on her phone, or on somebody else's phone. But this we can play. So it's a clip from Come Dine With Me. So we'll play the original clip first, and then we'll play your interpretation of it, and that'll give an idea to people exactly what you do. So here's the clip from Come Dine With Me. Hello.
In fourth place is me.
Oh. I don't know what you're shaking your head at me.
You won, Jane.
Oh, my God.
Enjoy the money. I hope it makes you very happy. Dear Lord, what a sad little life, Jane. You ruined my night completely so you could have the money, but I hope now you spend it on getting some lessons in grace and decorum.
That's unbelievable, isn't it?
Shocking. It's so funny.
Yeah. So, Michael, takes that. You take it nearly verbatim and you turn it into a song. Here we go.
You're very happy, dear Lord, what a sad little life, Jane. You ruined my night completely so you could have the money, dear Lord, what a sad little life, Jane.
See, lovely hook to that as well.
I've enjoyed doing it.
Yeah. So why, I suppose that begs the question, why wouldn't you pursue a career in music?
I suppose this is much funnier, I guess. So I get to combine all of my interests at once.
Right.
But I have actually released it, so I mean, it's kind of, yeah, I do have a music career.
Yes,
I guess,
you do. Well, it's a comedy music career, I suppose. They're available to stream now on Spotify, as in from the end of March, which is 2 weeks ago. So how has the reaction been?
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. In terms of like every week when I was doing those things, because I released a lot of them around the same time on the videos, they did really, really well. And so people were always like, oh, put it on streaming services. I want to listen to this while I run, all that kind of stuff. And then it came out and I've hit over 100,000 streams, which is just
amazing for all it is. Like,
you get a check for 10.57, I'd say, anytime soon.
I would say so, yeah.
And that is the thing, though, isn't it, Michael? Because you're hugely talented, you bring joy to a lot of people, and yet it's difficult for you to make money, is it?
Yeah, it depends on how you do it. I use a certain platform called Ko-fi, and what that does, it means it's kind of like busking. It's kind of like hat on the ground saying, okay, if you enjoyed this, you know, you can give me a few bob, but, you know, if not, grand, it's just there for you to enjoy or whatever. So, and people really do engage with that. So right. It hasn't been going too badly at the moment.
So it's like a digital hat there underneath your video.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Like if you saw someone on Grafton Street, you like, which they did, you can throw whatever you want in their hat, that kind of way.
Okay. You're doing a master's in what, digital media?
Yes. I didn't think I'd be as busy as I was over the last while. I thought, oh yeah, you know, I'll do the online stuff on the side, and then it kind of just took off, and I've been doing kind of ad campaigns and stuff like that, so it's been crazy busy over the last while.
Okay, so where is this all leading? I know, you know, it's dangerous enough to plan your life, particularly in show business. That's what they call it, I believe. but so is there a plan?
Not really, because we don't know when we're going to open up yet. So I mean,
beyond, you know, 5-10 years, all that, you know, where would you like to be, Michael?
I guess I'd love to be on the TV in some way, you know, but I'm not sure in what format. I'm also exploring live, so I'd love to do a stadium tour or sort of pie in the sky. I'd love to do the Eurovision. So,
nice. All right, there you go.
That's,
right?
Yeah.
Well, like if I was, you know, in a position of power of RTE, I would be giving you a call about the Eurovision. That brilliant guy.
Well,
Niamh is a big fan of that Icelandic guy from last year.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of kind of parallels there. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. There is a lot of parallels there. Because you can dance as well. You're a very good dancer.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
But no, but you're like,
I dance.
But you see, to mimic somebody's dancing, you need to be able to dance. Do you know what I'm saying? So, and you do mimic people dancing very well, which suggests to me that you can dance. Yeah,
maybe it's the Irish dance I did when I was a kid.
Oh, did you do Irish? Are you serious or joking?
Oh no, I did.
Oh,
I did.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And you've been to the Gaiety School of Acting. Yeah. So, and so the final question before I let you go, Michael Fry isn't your real name, and I read somewhere that you said that you don't know whether you're going to stick with it or not, or is it too late now to change it back?
I think it's probably too late. I feel like all of my history has been poured into that name.
Right.
And that's a persona now I've just got to keep up. But I really wish I'd picked a more exciting name than Michael. But here we are.
Right. So it's Michael Fry at Big Dirty Fry on Twitter or Instagram. And it's, of course, Michael Fry on Spotify if you want to hear more of his work, as in the singing comedy thing. Michael, I'm sure we'll chat again. Mind yourself.
Absolutely.
Stay safe.
See you later, right?
See you now. Bye. Bye. That's it from us. Cormac and Sarah are on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3:00. Whatever you're doing, do it safely.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.